Welcome to Amplified, the Federated Hermes podcast channel, where we discuss the key issues, challenges, and trends shaping the investment landscape. I'm Johan Murray, head of investment at the firm, and with me today is Andriy Kuznetsov, senior portfolio manager in our credit team. And we're going to take a look at the new decade for fixed income markets. Andriy, what's this new decade going to bring in fixed income for us?
Thank you for having me today, Johan. I think we are faced with an entirely new landscape in fixed income markets. If we look back over the past 10, 20 years, it's become increasingly global and diverse, both in terms of the country split, but also in terms of securities, sectors, the type of currency you can invest in, etc. Also, over the past 5 years, we've experienced a significant rise of passive investing within fixed income, and increasingly, we are facing a low-rate environment. This year, I think global bond ETFs have hit $1 trillion, and this is quite a significant milestone and expected to continue growing from here. Last but not least is, of course, the dominance of ESG factors in the fixed income markets. If you look at the past 2 years, all the participants in the market integrate ESG in one way or another, and it's an increasingly important factor when looking at both the fundamentals of a company and pricing the best security within a capital structure to invest in. Having said that, I also expect very strong demand for fixed income from the aging population. Over the next 3 decades, the number of people aged over 65 is expected to hit 1.5 billion from roughly 750 million at the moment. And this means that more investors will be looking for more reliable income and will not be able to take the equity-like risks in other parts of the market, which means there's more demand for fixed income products that offer lower volatility and also have the ability to preserve capital and provide some type of a downside defense and protection, because likely just buying the government bonds will not yield enough return to sustain your retirement. And as a result of that, the financing costs for companies in fixed income markets will go lower and the debt equity ratio will increase, and companies will increasingly come to the bond market to finance growth. Currently, global fixed income market is already bigger than the equity market. It has topped 100 trillion recently. And if we look more in the past few years, for example, the triple B segment of the market has experienced significant growth, partly because of the low cost of funding. The other thing that will become increasingly topical is the correlation between risk assets, such as equities, among other asset classes, and bonds. So over the last 20 years, we've experienced negative correlation. And as a result, the widespread use by investors of the barbell approach when you buy risky assets and you combine that with duration to protect your times of market volatility. But what a lot of investors don't realize is that, for example, from mid-60s to the late 90s, the correlation was positive. And the fact that we had negative correlation in the past 20 years is driven by disinflationary trends. And this can change. And as a result, investors, again, need to look beyond duration for protection of their capital.
Excellent. Let's unpack some of those ideas. I suppose historically, a lot of investors would have considered credit chiefly to be about picking the right corporate. Do you think that's changing now?
Absolutely, Johan. I think it's only 50% of the story is about choosing the right company, and the other half is about picking the right security within the capital structure. Increasingly, we moved from a market with few bond cap structure into multi-layered, multi-asset, multi-currency cap structures. So you need to choose the right currency. For example, now, if you look at the global fixed income space, US dollar is only 50% of the universe. In global credit, it's 2/3, which used to be almost 100% 1 or 2 decades ago. Looking at the type of securities, we are increasingly faced with multi-layered cap structures with different type of securities. For example, hybrids, both in the corporate and the financial world. Those two spaces together, the corporate and financial hybrids, are now almost $500 billion, which is quite significant compared to other parts of the market. Or, for example, if we look at the financial space, there you have additional Tier 1, you have Tier 2, senior non-preferred, senior, plus all the legacy securities, which is a lot of security selection to be done. Looking at geographical split of the universe, we moved from an asset class that was dominated by US companies into now having 85 countries in global high yield space. Europe, for example, moved from almost zero two decades ago to now accounting for almost a quarter of the market. EM, which is the fastest growing part of the universe, because of the high growth of EM economies at 2-3 times the developed market, has grown really fast. And looking at just only the hard currency part of the emerging markets credit space, it's almost $2 trillion at the moment, which is quite significant and requires increased attention from investors.
The rise of passive has been really pronounced in other asset classes. And you mentioned earlier on that the bond ETF market's supposed to hit about $1 trillion globally this year. So is that also true in credit? You're seeing this massive ramp up in passive?
In comparison to equities, it's much harder to replicate in a credit. But similar to the equities world, we are seeing a bifurcation. You have the high active share part of the market, which is where investors that are trying to deliver alpha. And on the other side, you have the passive, the low active share part of the market. And what is happening is over the past, say, 5-10 years, those players that are in the middle are losing assets to the passive because they are unable to deliver alpha to pay for the extra fees that is required in active management to support the industry. Also, what it means that the value of alpha, particularly in a low rate environment, is increasingly important. So all the extra basis points you can deliver from security selection, from dynamism or ESG integration is increasingly valuable when the overall level of carry in the market is low. Additionally, for active managers, in ESG engagement will remain a very important differentiating factor versus the passive world, which will increasingly focus, in my view, on exclusions and using in more complicated structures, looking at external rating agencies and using some kind of rule-based investing approach. If we look at, for example, at the current investment landscape, after strong 12, 13 months of performance in fixed income, now at the asset class level, the valuations look a bit rich or stretched potentially. But if you look under the hood, within the fixed income universe, there are plenty of opportunities. And this is one of the perfect environments for investment in high active share managers that only pick a select number of opportunities from the whole opportunity set within fixed income.
So you've talked about responsible investing playing a greater role in fixed income markets. How advanced is ESG integration in credit markets today?
ESG integration and responsible investment is arguably the fastest growing factor in fixed income and will increasingly dominate the space within the next 5-10 years. In general, fixed income is not different to equities. What matters, in my view, for equity markets also matters for the fixed income market, because in the end, we are senior lenders to the company with equity sitting below us. As a result, what benefits equity is better for us. Also, if it matters for enterprise value and cash flows of the company, those are the things that we can consider day to day doing our credit work. In terms of pricing, we've written a white paper around the correlation of ESG factors and cost of funding, and we've found that there's negative correlation, or the higher your ESG profile or the better your ESG profile is, the lower your cost of funding. And increasingly, companies want to engage with us and look at improving their profiles to, again, lower their cost of funding, particularly in emerging markets. And what's interesting, when we've rerun the numbers, say, I think last year, we saw that the curve, the relationship between the two has increased, i.e. as the more bigger part of the market is focused on these factors, the more important they are. And I think this is self-fulfilling prophecy and will only get stronger in the years to come. And as we have discussed earlier, the engagement within as part of the ESG integration will be an important pillar of differentiation versus passive, while the exclusion, which is much easier to replicate, unlike engagement, will go towards the passive route likely. At the same time, I think the biggest growth or the area of development within the ESG integration and fixed income responsible investment will be around both using those for both risk and alpha opportunities, for finding mispricings when those risks are mispriced, and also engaging, and also seeing those scores more dynamically, not just stale.
You mentioned a paper you'd written about ESG integration and credit spreads. That's one of a number of papers that you have written in the in that space. And how do you see the market for fixed income integration, ESG integration, evolving further then?
First of all, I would say that ESG integration will be a must because it's such a material factor for optimization of your of the risk return profile of your portfolios. It will be done across the board. I don't think you can ignore ESG going forward. But on the other side, so you have the ESG integration, but you also will have thematic products within fixed income space, such as ESDG based or impact, whatever they may be. And this is a response to a shift in attitude from asset allocators and younger generation from focusing on just returns to a more holistic approach to the outcome-based investing. On the other side, in terms of external agencies, I think that increasingly it will be similar to the rating agencies, where when you approach a credit manager or somebody who manages fixed income for you, they might subscribe to the rating agencies, but majority of the work and real value add that they are bringing to the table is around modeling those companies and seeing those credit profiles in a more dynamic way, forecasting, pricing them real time, and combining all of that together to generate alpha for investors. While I think the same, again, will be happening within the ESG space, where you'll have some part of the market that will be exclusion-based and focus on external rating agencies, but the more dynamic, the forward-looking, will integrate ESG inside, ideally at the analyst level. And the reason I say that, I think that the analysts know the sector better than anyone. They have the ability to assess the materiality and probability of different ESG factors within a sector, with obviously input from the dedicated engagers that have more up-to-date information of what's happening at the company level. But at the same time, the reason it's important to have it at the analyst level is to get the buy-in for the concept of ESG integration. And you need ESG as one of the factors when you assess an investment opportunity. As addition to the credit score, relative value, you need to also bake in ESG assessment when considering an investment opportunity.
So given all of that, and as we enter the 20s, what would you say would be the optimal setup for a truly global fixed income platform?
I think I would describe it in short as a flexible platform with dynamism, but conviction and ESG integration at its core. You need to be unconstrained by geography, types of securities, currencies. You need to break the silos. You need to consider not only the company you're investing in, but also the capital structure. Where's the best place within that capital structure? What offers the best risk-adjusted return per the added volatility that comes with that security? And for that, you need a team structure that respects that. You need everybody sitting together. You need sector specialists that, irrespective of the geography or type of securities follow companies within the same sector that compete together globally and can choose to issue different securities in different currencies, and it's all assessed by one analyst. With the talking about the different parts of the market now, with the growth of different geographies, type of securities, and also multi-layered cap structures with a lot of bonds, you need to combine both top-down and bottom-up to take advantage of this. And as a result, you need to focus on bigger capital structures, the capital structures that are more liquid, that enable you to be that dynamic. Because if you don't do that, you will not be able to reallocate capital at times of opportunity. And while you are being dynamic and flexible, you need to invest with conviction, because you need to realize that the passive is here to stay, and you need to be to show that you're able to deliver returns beyond that. And for that, and for bottom-up to matter, you need to take a high active share approach. And again, Johan, as we have discussed earlier, ESG integration needs to be at the core of what you do. At least because it's a very important factor in pricing the risks and opportunities for the investor, for the investment. But also, you need to engage with companies. By investing and changing companies, you're able not only to change the world potentially, but you also, in the process, can deliver the benefits to your investors and to companies by helping them lower their cost of funding. And in my view, that's best done at the analyst level.
Now, a lot of asset allocators, myself included, are concerned about the potential for the current cycle coming to an end. So what would you say are some of the key points to consider in terms of how best to access fixed income markets right now?
I think it's important to look back over the past 18 months, which were very interesting for a number of reasons. First is the pickup in dispersion or the pickup in defaults as the macroeconomic environment started slowing down in the mid-18, at which then fed through to the slower earnings and the pickup in defaults last year. And for the first time in a while last year, we saw the importance of credit skills, because for a while you could, everything moved in one direction and you could just take on more risk and deliver return. Last year is the first time in a while where you had to avoid those negative credit stories and protect the downside. The other thing, as we are moving towards the end of cycle, is the fact that you need to have a range of defense mechanisms in your portfolio or the framework how you're going to protect in volatile times. And this could be the dynamism or idiosyncratic management of idiosyncratic risk and security selection, sizing of risks appropriately, downside protection trades such as index or options, and again, using ESG for downside protection. And the other thing, as we have discussed earlier, the valuations in some parts of the market or even market overall look a little bit stretched after a strong run. And you need to look under the hood and look at different parts of the market, whether it's a sectoral opportunity, whether it's a regional opportunity, a rating opportunity, or just within a capital structure, and access those opportunities in a high active share way, i.e. allocating a significant amount of your capital to those opportunities to take advantage and deliver returns even at times where overall valuations are a bit challenged.
You've talked about the reappearance of defaults as a feature that we haven't seen in markets for a number of years. And so how do you think about capital preservation in this environment?
First of all, it's about dynamism. You need to focus on the liquid part of the market. You need to look at the world in an unconstrained way and identify which parts offer the best risk-adjusted return and be able to reallocate capital when the opportunity arises. Second, as we have discussed earlier, and you mentioned the pickup in defaults, you need to do the bottom-up work. You need to look at the fundamental factors such as the operational and financial risks. You need to combine that with the ESG elements of your analysis and then price those opportunities. It is important to not skip the bottom-up work that some investors might have got used to in the past few years. And you need to do a stress testing alongside your base case analysis, and again, focus within the capital structure on the securities that offer the best upside downside, or focusing what we call on what we call convexity. Also, you need to size your investment appropriately and use a range of different metrics and not just the dollars invested. One of the metrics we like to use is duration time spread. It's DTS, which is a measure of volatility. And when sizing opportunities, you need to consider a number of inputs. At the core of it, we have the credit quality, but you need to supplement that by the cyclicality of that business, the sovereign premium, if we are talking about a country with additional sovereign risk, with not necessarily being emerging markets. In recent times, we've experienced the same in UK or Italy and many other developed market countries. But also at the security level, taking into account the liquidity and volatility of that particular instrument. And then combining that sizing methodology with your daily ex post performance to look at correlation and how things behave combined. The other element of downside protection is using the relative value pair trades and options. At the times when we are in a low interest rate environment, every basis point you can gain from a relative value mispricing within the capital structures or within the same sector can have a bigger impact on your total return. At the same time, options are a very valuable tool at the end of the cycle when by systematically buying out of the money options and having protection in your pocket at the time of dislocation, for example, something like Q4 18, you're able to allocate capital to parts of the market that are more dislocated, which you would not be able to do if you didn't have that protection in your back pocket. And again, you can utilize actually ESG within your relative value bucket as well. You can pair companies that have different ESG trajectories in terms of their ESG profile, or within the same capital structures, you might take views on parts of the curve, saying that even though the ESG profile is getting worse, it will have an impact longer term on the company, but maybe short term, there's a relative value opportunities between the two, between the front end of the curve and the belly or the long end of the curve. And then ESG more holistically as a downside protection tool, having live ESG scores from your analyst combined with the input from the rest of the business, ideally an engagement part of the business, and pricing those risks and opportunities within a particular credit is important, because it seems that once we have experienced a pickup in defaults in the past 13, 18 months, suddenly you have more ESG issues coming to light. Because in a low growth environment where there are fundamental challenges for the business, maybe market pays more attention to some of the things that were sleeping behind the scenes before.
So when we were talking about the lateness of the cycle, you mentioned that spreads are tightened quite considerably, and in fact, I think almost back to 2008 levels. So what are the particular features that currently make credit an attractive space for investors?
You're right, Johan. In my view, credit has a place in investor portfolios at all times. It just depends in what shape or form. For example, for investors that are more cautious on the market and think that the end of cycle is near us, could be the next month, you could consider a low volatility product with high credit quality, so majority investment grade with some defensive characteristics. Something like that could deliver LIBOR plus 2 to 3%. On the other side, if you think that the cycle is not quite ending yet and the monetary policy stimulus and other forms, potentially fiscal stimulus coming, and you are more opportunistic, you could consider a higher wall product, a more dynamic top-down, multi-asset credit-like, with, for example, options overlay to take advantage of the dislocations, and something like that could come at LIBOR plus 5-6%, or something in the middle with some volatility, high level of conviction, some capital preservation elements delivering again something in the middle of, say, LIBOR 3 to 5%. So it all depends on what shape and form, on how much risk you want to take. Ideally, all those products will deliver similar Sharpe ratios or risk-adjusted return for investors.
So it feels like a lot of moving parts there. If you had just three things that you would recommend that investors focus on, what would they be?
I think you need to respect the new landscape, the new setup of the universe. You need to have the right team, the right structure in place to follow the investment process that is able to deliver those very valuable alpha in the age of low interest rates. At the same time, you have to acknowledge that passive space will continue to grow, and you need to focus on high active share approach, high conviction approach. You need to prove that you're able to identify those opportunities in the space and move dynamically. And the last is not, but not the least, as we have already discussed, is the ESG integration. It needs to be at the core of it, because you're able to deliver additional returns for clients. Ignoring it is not to the benefit of the client, and you also can do some amazing things if you have the right tools in place by changing the world and improving the environment.
Proper ESG integration everywhere. I love it. Thank you, André. And thank you for listening to Amplified. Until the next time, I'm Ewan Murray, Head of Investment.
Thank you for listening to the Federated Hermes podcast. If you found it interesting and would like to listen to more podcasts from the International Business of Federated Hermes, please visit our website. Our podcasts are also available to download on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. These podcasts are for informational purposes only, and the views, information, or opinions expressed therein are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of the company and its employees. Performance should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All performance mentioned is historical. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future results, and investors may not recover the full amount invested.